Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire has only 18 miles of actual coastline, but then there's our so-called hidden coast, more than 1,000 square miles of estuary, a network of rivers, streams, marshes, where freshwater meets the salty ocean. It's hard to overstate the importance of this area. Estuaries provide a nursery for the seafood we eat, protect towns from ocean storms, act as a filter to clean our water, and are just beautiful places to be. But now a new report finds Granite State estuaries are stressed out and that it's largely our fault. We pave too much, we build too much, we release too much junk into the water. And that's not even counting the additional harmful effects of climate change. Still, the authors believe that information is power, and their hope is that this new information will empower seacoast communities to adopt better strategies to protect the ecosystem. Estuaries are the topic today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Rachel Roulard. She's executive director for PREP, that stands for Piscataqua Region Estuaries Partnership, which works to protect the Great Bay and Hampton-Seabrook estuaries. And Rachel, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Also with us, Corey Riley, reserve manager at the Great Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve. And Corey, welcome.
Thank you.
And also with us, Ted Deers, administrator for the Watershed Management Bureau at the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And Ted Deers, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be back.
Well, the big question, all of you, and Ted, I'll turn to you first. Are New Hampshire's estuaries dying? Because there's a lot of troubling news in this report.
There is, Laura, but I think dying would be an extreme word in this case. We should be worried. We should be concerned. We should be taking action. But I'm often asked, how's the water, Ted, about the state of New Hampshire? And what I'll tell you is that compared to a lot of other places, our water quality is excellent. And the same is true with Great Bay compared to a lot of other estuaries around the country. We don't have fish kills. We don't have huge algal blooms. We don't have dying seaweed piling up on our shorelines and stinking up the place. We just don't have that. And that's really good that we don't, because once you're to that point, you're really over the edge and coming back is very, very hard and very expensive. So we should be worried. We should be taking action. But I think that to say that we're dying is probably not the right way to look at it.
Well, talk about some of the other estuaries, Ted, around the country and how they inform our efforts and inform what we see in this report.
Well, sure. I think that when you think about, you know, some of the larger estuaries around the country, San Francisco Bay, you look at Chesapeake Bay, Tampa Bay, Narragansett Bay, not too far away from here, the Massachusetts Bay is all around Cape Cod. You know, what you see there in a lot of those places are really some dire conditions. And in fact, Chesapeake Bay, you know, has had a monster effort that includes any number of states, thousands and thousands of participants, as well as, you know, billions of dollars which have been spent. And they're just now starting to see some of the improvement there. Tampa Bay completely replumbed essentially the whole city in order to start making their bay better. And you know what? It's come back.
Wow.
So it's not like this is hopeless. Things can happen, changes can be made, and I think other estuaries around the country have showed that.
Well, Rachel, how about you? How would you answer that question? Are New Hampshire's estuaries dying?
Well, like Ted said, I mean, that's pretty extreme. We want to raise the flag and say there are some issues. We have concerns. And this is the fifth report that we've done that shows there's a continuing degradation of our system. So we need to be concerned. But there are also some positive things that are happening. And as Ted said, you know, we don't have fish gills. We don't have these toxic algae blooms. I mean, there are things that are not happening here. So we need to continue to work to improve the underpinning of the ecosystem so that we don't get to that, into that situation. So we like to be a little bit more positive in how we talk about the future of the system so that we can continue to do the good things, continue the good things that are happening, so that we don't end up in a negative state.
Well, and I lived in the D.C. area for a time, and I remember when people said the Chesapeake Bay was dying, and it was pretty dire, and they had to make some giant changes to prevent that from happening. Formerly a beautiful area full of crabs and fish and so forth. So and that's the watchword. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's expensive. I mean, once you get past that point where you have to just look at restoration, it's very expensive. And we don't want to get there. So we're looking at things like, you know, our oyster populations, our eelgrass beds, our clam populations, those types of things that are those underpinnings of our whole system to make sure that they're healthy and that they can continue to provide a system that functions. So, you know, we don't want to get to a point where we have to plant eelgrass from the beginning and hope that somehow it can thrive and come back, because other systems have tried to do that and restoration is tough. So we have some good things to work with, and that's what we'd like to focus on.
I see. So restoration is harder than just keeping the health of what you have right now.
Absolutely.
What do you think, Corey? What's your broad assessment of how healthy our estuaries are?
I think that our estuaries are facing some major challenges, as Rachel and Ted have stated. But I also think that estuaries are amazing and that they are these really dynamic places that are able to bounce back. If they are of a certain sort of, if they're healthy enough, then they can really self-heal if we leave them alone. And if we could be proactive about how we impact the area surrounding the estuaries, then I think that we can be in great shape about being a national leader in how to avoid having to do expensive restoration. And we can really lead the nation in how to care for an estuary that has significant population centers around it, but also has great green space, committed communities, and engaged citizens.
A lot of estuaries, right, Corey, have a lot of people living around them. I was looking at some numbers last week, and I was struck by how many Americans live in coastal areas.
Oh, yes. It's staggering, but it also makes great intuitive sense. I mean, a lot of our historical cities were built around trade centers that relied not just on ocean transport, but on rivers as well. And so they have always been meccas for trade, meccas for economy, and they continue to be so today. Right now, people want to be on the coast because it's beautiful and because they love the lifestyle. But historically, it's been incredibly important to the vitality of any city.
Before we get any further and talk about the various indicators of our estuaries' health, I did want to get from you, Rachel, just describe the footprint of these estuaries that we're talking about. You know, where they are roughly and what towns and major rivers we're talking about.
Mm-hmm, sure. So we have two estuaries that are of national significance that are part of the National Estuary Program. That's Great Bay and Hampton Seabrook. And they have a drainage area that is about 1,100 square miles. So that reaches all the way up to Wakefield in New Hampshire, over to Candia, down to a little bit of Salisbury, Mass. So we dip slightly into Massachusetts and then up into Maine. We're up in Lebanon, over to York on the coast. So really, this area covers really three states.
So it's not just, you know, right by the coast, you know, Portsmouth, Rye, and Hampton.
No. And that's one of the interesting challenges that we have, is that when you're living up in a place like Wakefield, you're more connected to your river or your lake, your freshwater resource, and you don't think about the coastal drainage area. You don't think about the estuaries, certainly, because that's not in your backyard. It's not a place that you're familiar with. So, you know, communicating these issues and thinking about ourselves as a watershed, a cohesive community that's connected by water is a challenge for us. But there are also about 8 tributaries. Typically, we talk about 7 that feed the Great Bay and Hampton Seabrook. And the Piscataqua River, obviously, is the one that most people are familiar with. But we also have 7 other rivers coming from New Hampshire and 1 that comes from Maine.
So, and all the little feeder streams
and
that
all
feed
the
into
feeder
that.
Streams, so. Right, that go all the way up into that 1,000 square miles, way, way up in the watershed.
Well, if people want to look at maps, again, we've put the PREP report on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And you can give us a call right now, too, if you have questions or observations about the health of New Hampshire's estuaries, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Another just quick point of clarification from you, Rachel. Now, you described 2 estuaries in this larger Piscataqua region partnership, Great Bay and Hampton Seabrook. Is one in better shape than the other?
Well, no. That's the short of it. I mean, they both have their challenges. There are different types of concerns, especially in Hampton Seabrook. I mean, bacteria is a big issue. Of course, they have clamming, you know, a heritage of clamming down there, and that's not something that is done anymore, whereas Great Bay, it's a little bit different. Great Bay is a very dynamic system with all those feeder rivers, tidal tributaries, the currents, and Hampton Seabrook is more open. So they're very different.
Do you want to jump in, Ted?
Well, just one of the things about the 2 estuaries is the Great Bay is much better studied. So one of the challenges with Hampton Seabrook is that we haven't had enough, as much data as we've had on Great Bay. So I think answering the question and comparing them is a little challenging. And that's one of the things that we're working really hard right now to try to improve. We've, by virtue of some funds that were made available through the legislature, we have a new monitoring buoy that's going to go into Hampton Seabrook. That will be really the first time we've had continuous data gathered in that estuary as opposed to Great Bay, which we've had that for 20 years.
Well, and with the help of UNH, which is, you know, right, very connected to Great Bay. So I know they've done a lot of research there.
Yeah, I mean, a million graduate students have tromped about in the estuary. Yes.
Go ahead, Corey.
Yeah, and I'll just sort of jump on that and state that Great Bay has this legacy of civic engagement as well, dating back to the 70s, when Onassis was going to put a large oil refinery in Great Bay. And I think as a result of that, there have been a lot of citizen movements in cooperation with UNH to study, understand, and protect Great Bay. And the Hampton Seabrook estuary has some emerging groups that are just fantastic that are taking up that charge in that estuary and pushing for more citizen engagement and for more science in that estuary.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. We're finding out today in the exchange more about New Hampshire's estuaries and what kind of condition they're in. A new report lays out some pretty serious concerns. Let's go to the phones, all of you. And Jennifer's joining us from Exeter. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So we're really fortunate to have the stunning Squamscott and Exeter Rivers and a lot of other feeder streams flowing through Exeter. It's just a really beautiful part of why I think people are attracted to this town. And so I was just wondering if there's any state legislation slated for 2018 that would help protect and fund New Hampshire's coastal programs once the proposed national cuts to NOAA eliminate federal funding for critical organizations that help towns like Exeter and other coastal towns, have thriving communities that support these estuaries.
Okay, Jennifer, thanks for the call. Ted?
So we are tracking a lot of legislation. As you may be aware, there's about 1,000 bills that have been placed onto the docket.
That's typical this time of year,
for this
yes.
upcoming. And I would say that there aren't any bills specifically like the one you're talking about. There certainly are a number of different bills that are out there to talk about different aspects of water quality and water quality protection. But in terms of what's happening with the budget, this is not a budget year. So the biennial budget was set in the last session. And so I don't know of any specific bills that are coming out to do the kinds of things that you're suggesting.
Well, and Jennifer, I'm glad you called because it raises a broader question. Ted, I'll turn to you first, but anybody jump in. The challenges that these estuaries face are complex. You've all described it as sort of a dynamic yet delicate system. So who's responsible, Ted, for making sure that these things stay in the great shape that you, or the good shape that you say that they're in, and that they don't turn into, you know, Tampa Bay?
Right. Well, I think that the answer to that is that it's everybody's job at this point. Gone are the days when the particular, you know, we had giant polluters. We had industry. It was easy to point at those people and say, there's the problem.
That big pipe spewing nastiness,
yes. That is no longer the case. So when you look at how water quality is affected, especially by stormwater, and I think stormwater is the primary culprit these days. As we look across all of our watersheds, 90% of our water quality problems in New Hampshire stem from stormwater. So that means the rain comes down and it washes all the junk off of the land, and that junk, whatever contaminants, pollutants, whatever, ends up in our waterways. So that's really the solution is about stormwater. The solution is about how we're protecting lands, how we're creating buffers around our water bodies. Those are the kinds of solutions. And those can't be implemented by the state. That is not necessarily the things that we can make happen. There are certainly some state laws that do some of that. But this is most of these are local decisions.
So the communities are very involved. Decisions.
Or individual decisions. When do you put the fertilizer on your lawn? Where do you put it? How do you treat the rain that comes off of your driveway? What do you do in your backyard? And it's so much more challenging than fixing that giant pipe spewing nastiness.
Do you want to jump in on that, Rachel? This is a really important point.
Yeah, I mean, Ted's absolutely right. It's in New Hampshire, it comes down to the community level and to our individual values and behaviors. And I think we're on a learning curve here. A lot of us are starting off not really thinking much about how what we do on our properties affects our water quality in our larger watershed. I mean, those are even new terms for a lot of people, like watershed. So making sure that you're taking care of things like your septic system, that you're thinking about the nitrogen that you're putting down to fertilize your lawn, those are really critically important things. And supporting your community when they want to do upgrades to their infrastructure or there's a bond for land conservation, those things that help to really maintain environmental quality and health in general also trickle down literally and figuratively into our water. So I would say that.
Go ahead, Corey.
I just want to circle back to whose job it is. And it is everybody's job. And we all want the community decisions and the individual decisions. We want that to be where the decisions happen. But a lot of those things are going to take resources that either communities don't have all of the resources for or the state doesn't have the resources for. So the question that Jennifer from Exeter originally asked was really linked to different funding sources. And I just want to state that is important. And we do receive a lot of federal funding in this region to help enable communities to make the best possible decisions and help make sure that individuals understand what options are available to them.
So give us an example of what that means. Help communities or enable communities to make the best decisions. Does that mean a federal grant to help you upgrade your wastewater treatment plant so you're not dumping as much gunk into the river?
Well, absolutely. That's part of it.
To get specific. Yeah.
Yes. And I think all three of us have different federal sources that contribute quite a bit to water quality in New Hampshire. My own program has 75% of its funding that comes from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And that funding supports water quality monitoring, monitoring of the biological communities in Great Bay, technical assistance to communities surrounding Great Bay, and education for K-12 students.
Well, so on this question of who's responsible, and we could pick at that all hour, but Ted, New Hampshire does have a Shoreland Protection Act in place for well over a decade, maybe even two decades. Looking at all the problems this report outlines, what does that say about the effectiveness of the Shoreland Protection Act?
Well, it's a lot more than just the Shoreland Protection Act. The Shoreland Protection Act really covers just that first, 150 feet, 250 feet, 50 feet. You know, there's different zones within that cover what can and can't happen within those zones. That certainly is helpful. It certainly protects, to a great extent, the water that's coming off of the land. But remember, we had a long history before that happened. And we have other kinds of different infrastructure, stormwater infrastructure, that essentially bypasses that protected area.
So, right, because you talked earlier about the threat of stormwater and how that really is a huge problem. So it makes me wonder, is the Shoreland Protection Act good enough?
It may be for what it's intended to do, but it doesn't solve all the problems.
All right, lots more of your calls after a short break. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
What makes New Hampshire, New Hampshire? Is it the people?
The Synchro Sisters come marching into town like they've never seen a cloud in the sky.
Or is it the landscape?
We glide out beyond Willoughby Point until Chikoro Island, Church Island, as it's
perhaps it's a little of both. I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this holiday season, consider supporting the station that connects you to the people and places unique to New Hampshire with a tax-deductible year-end gift to NHPR. Give now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the state of New Hampshire's estuaries. A new report says they're under stress. We're finding out more, and let's hear from you. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Also on our website, you can find a copy of the report that we're looking at. Our website is nhpr.org/exchange. And later on today, we'll have coverage of the report from our environment reporter, Annie Ropeek, and a great graphic of how this whole system works created by Sarah Plourd. You can join us now at 1-800-892-6477. And Corey, before we go to the phones, I did want to ask you what I asked Ted Deers just before the break, which is, you know, you guys all talked about how runoff is maybe the biggest threat that our estuaries face. This is, again, you have an extreme rain event. We've had a lot of these. All the gunk washes off the driveways and the roads and the pavement and into the estuary, and it creates a lot of problems. And it made me think, you know, what about the Shoreland Protection Act? I mean, I thought that this was supposed to protect our shorelands from a lot of this.
Yes, absolutely. That's the intent. And I think that there are parts of it that work very well. Rachel and Ted and I and a few other partners a few years ago sat down and said, what are some of the most impactful things that could happen to improve water quality in Great Bay? And we all said that one of the things that would be most influential is if we could strengthen the buffer around Great Bay. And when I say buffer, I mean if we could have vegetated cover around Great Bay that could help mitigate the stormwater.
Bushes, grass, trees,
to help trap those nutrients before they get to the bay, to help keep our impact a little further away from the water.
And nutrients, sorry to interrupt, but nutrients means bad things, because most people think nutrients, that's in breakfast cereal, that's good.
Yeah, well, they are good, but just like anything, you can have too much of a good thing. And sometimes Great Bay has too much nitrogen, which is essential for growth, but too much of it makes too much growth in the wrong places and causes an imbalance in the system.
Okay, so you all sat down and you said, look, the number one thing you can do for the Great Bay is to strengthen this Shoreland Protection Act, make a bigger vegetative buffer around the Great Bay. What happened?
Well, our target wasn't really legislation. Our target was, what can we do to understand how buffers work and promote them and their use? Because it's not right now, the Shoreland Protection Act does not protect every wetland or every type of water body in the state. And so we know that there are gaps in the legislation. There are problems with enforcement because it's a tremendous amount of effort and capacity needed at the local and state level to ensure that these regulations are, you know, people are taking them seriously. And we know that there are gaps in what is protected. And the fact that there is, I'll call it a weaker state legislation around buffers, enables communities to have stronger local ordinances, but it makes it a patchwork of very inconsistent regulations around buffers, which is hard for developers, it's hard for landowners, and it's hard for both the state and local people who are trying to enhance water quality.
And everybody wants that open, unimpeded view of the river or the shore and so forth.
Right.
But that does create problems for the water.
Right. So one thing we have worked together on with several other partners, including the Nature Conservancy, notably, is a project over the last few years called Buffers on the Bay. And that will be wrapping up this spring. And it was really organized just to get the best scientific information that's available around buffers, to do a policy assessment, and to understand what sort of community attitudes around buffers are as well.
All right. Well, let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Wayne is in Durham. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks very much for listening in. I don't know if I caught it, but the major threat to Great Bay right now is the Seacoast Reliability Project just proposed by Eversource. The coalition that beat Onassis, which I was in, has reorganized to watch this project to blow a trench across Great Bay, and the initial studies were deeply flawed. We also found out that Eversource claims no liability or responsibility for any damage they might do, which is why I've filed a bill to make them accountable and responsible. But I was wondering if the people there had any reaction to the fact that most of the marine biologists at UNH are opposed to the plan as it currently exists.
Well, and for listeners in other parts of the state, Wayne, who might not know what that project is, just real quick, what is it?
It's to extend transmission lines to the seacoast. Eversource claims that they lack the capacity to serve well the seacoast, but there are other options. But the one they chose was to build a new transmission line from Madbury through Durham across Great Bay into Newington and into the transformer there. We believe that just doing the building a better transformer would work, but they've fought us tooth and nail, and we had to hire our own.
And Wayne, I'm going to jump in. Just you gave us the basics, so that's great. Thank you. Corey, for me, it raises the broader issue of, you know, development. It's kind of what you talked about earlier. People want to live on the seacoast. People want to, you know, live in this gorgeous area, but they also want houses and electricity and roads, and, you know, they don't want to live like pilgrims. So it's tricky.
Yeah, and I'll just maybe to respond a little more directly to Wayne, say that for Ted and I, we both work for state agencies, and there's a process for which our agencies were able to comment on the application for the Seacoast Reliability Project. So he and I are not able to really comment in detail on that project because of where we sit within agencies. But I will say that we've had a great relationship with the biologists working on that project, and they've been very forthcoming with our agency about questions that we have had about that project. And we are kind of looking at it carefully because we understand that, of course, it is going right through the estuary.
I'd love your thoughts too, Rachel, on just the idea, the broader idea that I think this call raises, which is balance. Again, you know, coastal areas are extremely popular. You can't say to people, don't live there. But it's tough, you know. More people means more roads, more parking lots, more malls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
No, we certainly don't want to say don't live there. We love it. I live there. And people are coming to New Hampshire all the time and settling in the seacoast because it's such a great place to live. And part of what makes it great is that we have all these places to recreate. It's a culturally rich place with a great history. It's beautiful. It's relatively clean. It's economically robust. It's a wonderful place. So this is about balance. And we certainly are not saying that growth shouldn't happen, that people shouldn't be coming here, but we have to think carefully about how we accomplish that. So one of the things that we track in the report, they were concerned about the ties to the sort of non-point source pollution and stormwater issue is impervious cover. So as we develop more
impervious cover, you have to say what that is.
Oh, impervious cover is like pavement, roofs for houses, anything where the water can't naturally drop and filter into the ground. So we have to think about ways that we can accomplish that, where we have people coming, we have development that's going to happen. We want all that. You know, we want to be able to go to, you know, our Trader Joe's or the movie theater or whatever it is that you like. So how can we do those things in ways that are smarter so we're not contributing to additional pollutant loads going into our waterways? And there are a lot of people working on that. The Stormwater Center at UNH is doing some great things. There's some test sites, the city of Dover's, DPW, group is doing some great stuff. They very inventive and creative test projects that are working. So there's a lot to be excited about. So there are ways that we can balance the demands of growth and people wanting to be here with environmental health.
Well, it's interesting, and I'll throw this to anybody, but Corey, if you want to jump in, go ahead. Talking about impervious surfaces, and again, that's pavement where the stormwater comes down and whoosh, rushes off and causes the problems you've described. Scientists at the Stormwater Center at UNH have been working for a long time on pervious pavement. So this is pavement that acts like the ground. It sucks stuff up, but it doesn't seem to be widely adopted. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, I think that there are a lot of innovative technologies in stormwater management and in septics that we could be adopting here in the Seacoast region. And I think that taking them out of an academic setting and getting them to be practically applied has been a really amazing thing that's happened with the Stormwater Center over the last couple of years. And they've really been studying how innovation catches on between communities and have learned a lot from the DPW directors in places like Dover to make it more realistic and easier for the maintenance crews to actually make these things happen. Because sometimes it doesn't have to be a really expensive and over-engineered solution. It can just be a tweak and the way things are done or maintained that makes a huge difference to water quality. And I think that when you look at the State of the Estuaries report and some of the guidelines for municipalities, you'll see that a lot of the things aren't crazy technology-driven futuristic ideas. It's really just being careful about where you put infrastructure and how you build and maintain it. So it's not anything that's terribly new. It's really tweaking what we already do and making sure that we always have that hydrology. How is the water going to move in our system, in
Let's
our heads?
Let's slow it down.
Let's
and,
slow
and
it
suck
down.
It up.
Let's let it suck up. And also, I mean, if you're taking these actions, whether it's land acquisition, buffers, or managing stormwater, you're not just fixing one problem. You're also helping mitigate some of the threats that may be coming due to climate change with increased precipitation and rising sea levels.
I would love your thoughts, too, Ted, on this pervious pavement issue. I know scientists at UNH were so excited about it, but it doesn't really seem to be widely adopted.
So I'd like to just give a quick example, because I think bringing this down to earth, and a shout out to the city of Dover, there's a particular watershed called Berry Brook, and we helped DES help fund a watershed study there that identified that they had about 30% or over 30% impervious surface. That means that 30% of the watershed is paved. A lot of water quality problems. Over the last 5 or 6 years, the city has been investing and also working with landowners to invest and really install some of these innovative controls, some of these innovative stormwater controls. We don't tell them exactly which ones to use. Should you just use pervious pavement? Well, that's one option. But there's a suite of options. And so what they have done is they've found the right solution for the right place, given all of the factors, because remember, they have to maintain these. That's one of the problems with pervious pavement, is then maintaining it afterwards. So the really smart people at DPW and in the city of Dover have figured this out and have implemented a huge number of projects, spent lots and lots of dollars as well as some federal dollars that have come in through our programs. And they've taken that imperviousness, they've disconnected it so that they've allowed it to infiltrate, and effectively they've gone from 30% down to about 10%.
Wow, that's a big change.
And that's when you start to see water quality improvement.
So that's a lot less runoff on hard pavement getting soaked up or sucked up somewhere somehow just by making changes that work for that particular community.
Right. And so this is possible. These are the things that are possible by communities implementing stormwater management ordinances. So getting those into their ordinances, working with landowners, looking at redevelopment. We have lots of people redeveloping the seacoast. And so what do you do when that new property becomes available? You can really add a lot of these elements in that were never there before.
Well, a little bit later in the hour, we'll talk to another Department of Public Works person from the town of Exeter and find out what that town is doing. Wayne, thank you again for that call. Let's go next to Chris in Nashua. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thanks.
Sure.
Love this topic. I'm a diehard environmentalist and have been so for many years. But one challenge that I've found from the environmental movement in general, and I've been watching it for like 30 years now, is that, you know, we have all kinds of wonderful ideas, but at the end of the day, politicians have very short attention spans, and they have a wide variety of, you know, agendas they have to meet. So if you were to, I'm speaking to the experts now, if you were to meet one of these, you know, the whole legislature, let's say, and you could have a magic wand, and you could make them do one thing, you know, mandate one thing or spend money on one thing, I'm curious as to what that one thing would be. And, you know, maybe this is like a Christmas present kind of thing.
I love the question, Chris. Rachel, I'll put you on the spot first.
Okay, I'm on this. What I would love is a whole bunch of resources to talk with people, teach people, engage people, and get them to become stewards in a way that makes sense for them of the place that they live. So whether they're up in Wakefield and they're paddling on their favorite river, or they're kayaking in the bay, or they're fishing in their river in, Dover, I'm just making stuff up as I go, that they would understand a little bit more about these challenges and have clear ways that they could plug in to being stewards of the places that they love. And that does take resources. It takes time. It takes really good, careful, thoughtful communication. So we struggle with that because there is such a large population of people that we want to communicate these things to and pull them in and help them figure out how to be stewards and to contribute to the solutions that we're talking about here. But it's tough to be resourced to do that.
What does be a steward mean for just the individual person who kind of, gets up in the morning and drives to work and comes home?
It just means simply taking care of. So what can you do to take care of where you live, whether it's your home, whether it's your yard, your neighborhood, your watershed, your community, your region? So whatever scale in whatever way that translates for you. Some people, it's their church community. Other people, it's a recreational community. So there are ways to be stewards of physical resources, but also within groups that you associate with. We have a hunter and police officer in Greenland who's a wonderful steward, Ted Hartman. He and his group of duck hunters, they've been out on Great Bay for many years hunting ducks, and they've removed thousands of pounds of trash. Just in their own interest. They search the shore every morning before they start hunting to pick up reflective material that scare ducks away. So there are ways that you can do this and become a steward of something you care about in this place in a very personal way.
Well, Ted, how would you answer Chris's question? Thank you, Chris.
So I think we talked about this a little bit, and I think that the example I gave of Dover is a good one, in that the communities themselves and some of the other organizations that work in the communities really being focused on non-point source pollution. There are very few sources of funding, very, very few, for those communities to be able to enact these kinds of ordinances, to have the planners there to get them done, to have the enforcement necessary, and really is to getting dollars to fund those infrastructure projects. This is a huge problem. We have in this state a multi-billion dollar infrastructure problem just because all of our infrastructure is getting old.
And you're talking about pipes, wastewater treatment plants, the whole thing.
But remember, stormwater is part of our infrastructure. How do we deal with all of that? And that's woefully underfunded. So that's a huge problem. And that's certainly true at the federal government level and in the state government. We're a thrifty place. So if all of a sudden some dollars could fall down for the communities and for other groups to be able to do non-point source protection, that would be amazing.
Go ahead, Corey.
Well, Ted sort of took the words right out of my mouth, because I think that the challenge is making sure that we have the resources to make changes when we have an opportunity to invest in transportation or infrastructure upgrades, to take into consideration both stormwater and climate change. There are more funding opportunities for people to plan than there are for people to do. And I would love to see that dynamic flipped.
It's interesting, and Ted, you talked early in the show about it's better to protect and preserve what we have than try to do restoration, once things have started dying out. When I first read the report, I thought, wow, I want to just put on my waders and plant eelgrass and, put in oysters and shellfish and sort of try to restore some of what has been lost. And there's a lot that has been lost, as this report outlines. Does that do any good? Is that worth even spending money on?
Absolutely. We've been doing salt marsh restoration for years. We're now doing river restoration, trying to get fish up to where they need to be. They've been doing a bunch of shellfish restoration by putting shell out so that the shellfish have a place to go.
Because shellfish help clean the water
as well. Right, exactly. But I think just to turn the conversation a little bit, the thing that's really great about the State of the Estuaries report, and I think that the new thing that's coming out about this, and Rachel mentioned that there's been five reports, is the focus on resilience. And I hope that maybe after we have a break, we can come back and talk a little bit about how this concept of resilience helps us pull a lot of these threads together.
Okay. After a break, we will pick up on that. And we'll also hear from the head of the Department of Public Works in Exeter. And we'll take a lot more of your calls, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire's estuaries. A recent report says they're under extreme stress. You can check out the report on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And you can join our conversation right now. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And Rachel, I did want to ask you, picking up on what Ted said just before the break, this report by your group, PREP, Piscataqua Region Estuaries Partnership, is done every 5 years. We're talking now about the 2018 version. What's really different from the last time that you did this?
Well, this is the first time we've had a five-year period for the report. Previously, they were done every 3 years. And we pushed this one a little bit further out because we wanted to have more data that we could look at to look in the context of long-term trends. Also, we were working on the development of new social indicators. This is a new thing in the report. We have three indicators of basically social behavior and well-being. Because humans are an integral part of the landscape, we felt it was really important to start thinking about human behavior and how that relates to environmental condition and how they support one another.
So what does that mean specifically?
We wanted to understand a little bit more about how humans interact with the landscape, the things that we value and the behaviors that we have and how those interact with environmental condition, with particular regard, obviously, to the estuaries. So we went through a 2-year process where we evaluated different data sets and we talked with partners and we thought about, well, what can we do? What's going to tell the social story, the human story about how we're interacting with our system? So we ended up looking at housing permits. So how many people are coming here? How many new houses are being built as in terms of a pressure? So what types of human pressures are we feeling in a way that we can measure? The second thing we looked at were stormwater regulations. So what are communities doing? How are they answering these pressures? And the third one was personal. It's about stewardship behavior. So what do we have for volunteerism amongst people in the population on the seacoast, which goes to my earlier point about wanting to have more resources to engage people who are living here in personal ways.
Which I thought was really interesting. I thought you might say something like what Ted said, which is, well, we could use better water infrastructure. But if you, again, could wave that magic wand that our caller Chris talked about, you would wave it so that just every individual would kind of get it about what their role is.
Yeah, because the solution that we're talking about is going to take everybody. And we do need those resources. I mean, that Ted mentioned, we do need resources from every sector. We need philanthropic help. We need private sector help. But we need people, individual citizens, just to, you know, start thinking about their stewardship. So this was another indicator that we chose to start thinking about and measuring how people are using volunteer time. The other new thing that we included in the report is really context for the 23 indicators that we use to measure the health of the system. And we produced a new section called Stress and Resilience. And that was to tie it all together, to talk about how does an estuary work? How do stresses affect an estuary? And then what needs to happen to have a healthy system? And it's complicated. We do have a very, you know, dynamic system. There are a lot of things at play, a lot of factors that relate to one another. But the definition of resilience is the capacity of an ecosystem to absorb repeated disturbances or shocks and adapt to change without continually degrading and fundamentally switching to an alternative stable state. So that is a very
Put that in layperson terms.
So if you're going to go to the doctor and you don't exercise and you don't eat well and you don't sleep well and you're not doing anything to manage your stress, you're not a very resilient person. So if you're exposed to a cold or a flu, you know, you're pretty likely to get the cold or flu, and then it's going to take you a long time to recover from that episode. So what we're talking about environmentally is having a healthy system. So it's going to the doctor and you're exercising regularly, you're eating well, you're getting your sleep, you're managing stress, those things, your blood pressure is good, your cholesterol levels are good. That means when you get sick, if something unexpected happens, you're going to recover quickly and you're able to recover. So we're trying to help really support those aspects of our system that will help it to be resilient and strong and be able to recover when we get big storms that are washing a lot of pollutants into the system.
But from what I read in the report, and Ted or Corey, if you want to jump in on this, from what I read in the report, our estuary's resiliency is down because of years and years and years of, you know, runoff into the water from parking lots or roads or whatever, years and years of sudden rainstorms, large rainstorms, years and years of communities not doing what they might want to preserve the estuary in terms of wastewater treatment. So it seems like, I'll turn to you, Corey, that resiliency for these estuaries is not great.
That's right. The major finding from the report was that there's a concern by PREP and by the partners that our estuary is not resilient enough. And what it takes to be resilient is a combination of healthy indicators. It's not one thing that's going to, you know, you can't say, oh, we're resilient, we've made it to a certain level on one item. You really have to have a healthy biological community, a microbial community, a water quality, indicators that are doing okay in order to handle the episodic events. And I just, I know that there have been people who have been working hard to do their part, and we haven't mentioned yet the significant upgrades that some communities have made in their wastewater treatment systems. And I think we all acknowledge that there are tremendous resources that are need to be done, and we just really are thankful that the communities and the citizens in those communities have supported those efforts.
Well, speaking of the community-by-community effort, we've got now on the phone Jennifer Perry. She's Public Works Director for the Town of Exeter. And Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So just describe for us, the layperson, how the work of your department interacts with the estuary. You know, what tasks that you do that might affect the health of the estuary.
Well, there are quite a few aspects of our operations that do affect our receiving waters. And obviously, the most important would be our wastewater treatment plant. And that has a major impact on the Squamscott River. We also have our street operations that affect stormwater, so we have street sweeping. We have dams that are upstream in the freshwater portion of the Exeter River that we have been very successful working with regional and federal agencies to remove one of our dams. There are just so many aspects of what Public Works does that
sure.
do impact water.
Roads, pipes, wastewater, and so forth. So in the years that you've been in this business, Jennifer, how have you changed the way that you operate based on concerns about estuary health?
Well, we've really had to make it a focus and a priority for everybody in the department. It's not just something that is touted by the director. It's something that has to be adopted by everybody in the department, and more than just Public Works. It's also, it affects planning department, it affects economic development, and the town has excellent staff. We have a great leader in our town manager and our board of selectmen, and everybody has to get on board. A lot of times Public Works is on the front line, if you will. We're kind of the boots on the ground, the implementers, but we have to work very closely and get the support of the voting public. That's absolutely essential, that we need to pass along information so that people know what's coming up at the ballot box. And we've had great great experience with that.
What does getting on board mean? You said everybody needs to get on board with better protection of the estuary. Give us a specific, Jennifer.
Well, for instance, even within, say, our highway department, we do street sweeping and catch basin cleaning, cleaning the drain lines, but we have to do it more frequently. And if the staff don't appreciate why that is so important, it can be, you know, a little bit more of a struggle. Instead, we have people that understand the importance of those operations, and they make it a priority.
I see. So if you're street sweeping more often and cleaning more often, there's less junk running into the river.
Correct.
So much of this effort to improve estuary health that we've been hearing about, Jennifer, and I'm sure you understand this, is being done at the local level, like you in Exeter. Ted Deers has talked a lot about the example that Dover has presented. How much variation do you see, Jennifer, among what different towns are doing?
Well, each community does have a unique approach. Every community has may have a different location as far as where they are within the watershed. Some are farther removed from Great Bay or the Hampton-Seabrook estuary, but they all ultimately do have an impact. So, for instance, in Exeter, we are on the Squamscott River, which flows into Great Bay. We really know we've focused our efforts on upgrading our wastewater treatment plant for nutrient removal. That was an imperative for us. We had an older facility that wasn't doing a great job with nutrient removal. Other communities already had the ability to fine-tune their facilities. So it does vary from town to town. Other towns may not have wastewater treatment facilities, but they have private septic systems, and education for property owners that have septic systems is a critical role that the community can play.
Any other last thoughts you want to leave us with, Jennifer, just in terms of, you know, what it means to be a public works director in this day and age when there is a lot of concern about dying eelgrass, you know, dying mussels and oysters, invasive seaweed in the Great Bay, a lot of problems. So what's it like for you to be a public works director in this time?
Well, it certainly is challenging. But at the same time, I think it means a lot. We all know that we have a very large role to play. We take it seriously. You know, we want to be the best stewards for the municipalities that we can be, and we want to have a meaningful impact. We have to, you know, we do have limited resources. We're truly affecting tax rates, sewer rates, and we have to be responsible fiscally. But it's very important. Most of the residents that live in our communities have moved here or live here because they love the region, including Great Bay. So I think it, even though it's a challenge, it's a great opportunity, and I'm very proud of the work that I've been doing, that my department's been doing, and I know that other directors in the region feel the same way, that we're really making an impact, and we're proud of that.
Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Jennifer Perry, Public Works Director for Exeter. So all of you, we've talked about Exeter, we've talked about Dover. Here's an email from Katie in Portsmouth who says, what could the city of Portsmouth do as a municipality to protect and improve estuary health? Ted?
Well, I'll let others jump in as well, but I would just say that Portsmouth has been incredibly proactive. They have an environmental planner. They've had one for years and years. They've been focused on this for a long time. And they are doing a lot. There's a new project that's getting underway in the Sagamore watershed, which I think is we're all very excited about, and that's a nice partnership. There's they've been working a lot on separating their stormwater. That's why downtown has been under construction forever, is because they've been, you know, separating out, getting their sewage and their stormwater separated. They've been doing a lot of work on stormwater controls. It's a very urban population there. So it's hard to do those kinds of projects. It's very expensive. And every time they have to rip up one of the streets downtown, it's a major sacrifice for the people who are trying to get around. So all of that they've been doing. They're building a new wastewater treatment plant. So they really are. And I think the other place where they're focused is really been on their susceptibility to sea level rise. And that's a huge thing. We don't think about that as a water quality issue. But think about all those resources that sit there in that zone that also can be exposed to that more water during higher tides more frequently that will cause additional pollution problems.
So one of the functions of estuaries, Ted, correct me if I'm wrong, is to protect communities from coastal storms. So if Portsmouth is kind of vulnerable sitting there right by the ocean with the estuary around it, if the estuary is in better shape, it could better protect Portsmouth from those major storms.
Right. In fact, they have a really cool Living Shoreline project that they're working on. They have some other projects to restore some of the structures that we talked about, the resiliency against all kinds of insults.
Let's take another call. This is Gene in Bennington. Hi, Gene. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. I think that and I appreciate the concern everyone has about all the environmental protection. I think there are many people, there are as many people who don't care as there are that do. And I'm wondering about all the construction in Northampton and Rye, where they, you know, they build condos right on the marshes, and when they build places, it seems like, you know, it can be as big as they want. They can be palaces, and or when they do renovations, they, you know, they build these huge renovations. And I'm wondering is
how that goes on, given concerns about estuary health. And Gene, I got to cut you off there just in the interest of time, but I do appreciate the question. And I do wonder, he's right. There's lots of construction that goes on the seacoast. We've talked a lot this hour about how popular it is for tourists and visitors. So all of you, I mean, what's the solution to that? Do town planners or regional planners just say, no, you can't build that hotel? I mean, people want the tourism dollars. No, you can't build that big house. It's nice to get those property taxes. I mean, at what point do planners, zoning people, city officials, Corey, I'll turn to you, say, no, you can't do it. Estuary is too vulnerable.
Yeah, that's a decision that the communities need to make. And if there are places where the state can help support and give them information and coordinate across communities, that's the role. And that's the role, honestly, of the organizations that are sitting around the table as well, is to help those dialogues happen and help people see that there's always a trade-off. And that if you want the services that the estuary provides, the recreational services, the clean water, the flood protection, then there may be trade-offs you need to make in how you want your development patterns to happen within your communities.
How comfortable are local officials with saying no to that new housing development, to that new hotel?
Yeah, I think that the intent is often very is very good. I think that we all have an issue when it's our neighbor that comes to us and asks for this one little variance or this one little exception. And I think if you talk to people who are in these local decision-making positions, that's the issue, is that it's a lot of what we call cumulative impacts or little tiny exceptions to the rule that add up to be a large problem for the estuary.
And you don't want to get into the drawbridge issue, which is, you know, you guys live on the seacoast, that's great, but you can't say to other people, well, you can't live on the seacoast, you know, and just say no more houses now that I'm here. I mean, that's a typical issue as well.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate you raising the point, Gene. It's actually fodder for a future show, I think. So all of you, thank you very much for being here. We'll put a copy of the report on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. The report's already up, and later today there'll be some great reporting from our environmental reporter and some graphics from Sarah Plourd on this. For now, though, thank you so much for being here, Rachel. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Roulard, Executive Director for PREP, Piscataqua Region Estuaries Partnership. Corey Riley, good to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Corey Riley, Reserve Manager at the Great Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve. And Ted Deers, thank you for coming in.
Always fun, Laura.
Ted Deers, Administrator for the Watershed Management Bureau at the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.